derivation of the temperature that we have in the Unruh effect. And all of this is really a warm-up to the de Sitter case that we're going to hopefully get to later. So just to remind you, we're thinking about a massless scalar field in two dimensions, for simplicity. And we started with the two-dimensional Minkowski metric written in capitalized coordinates that covers the whole space. And then we defined some light cone coordinates, t plus or minus x, such that this is really the same as dx plus dx minus. And then we derived a map from those light cone coordinates to a new set of light cone coordinates, small x plus or minus, with some scale in here, which is the acceleration scale. And we plug that in, and we get, and little x plus or minus is itself written in terms of little t plus or minus x. So there's a capital system of coordinates, and there's the small system of coordinates. And then this ends up being e to the 2ax minus dt squared plus dx squared, or had we written it in terms of these, minus e to the a x plus minus x minus dx plus dx minus. And the point of all those tricks is that these are the coordinates that are the natural system of coordinates for an accelerated observer. In particular, if you look, so if we draw a picture of what's going on here, this is two-dimensional Minkowski space in normal Cartesian coordinates, and these are two light cones here going through the origin. And this system of coordinates, the little x and the little t, are basically covering lines that go like this, where it may not be fully clear from my picture, but it should be in practice, is that all these surfaces asymptote to traveling at the speed of light as you go far out. So these are the lines of constant x. And they are all lines or geodesics. Well, they're not geodesics. They're trajectories of constant acceleration. So in other words, in the frame of reference of an accelerated observer, everyone that's rest relative to the accelerated observer is accelerated. And that's what that system of coordinates covers here. And the key point about them is that we have two killing vectors that are quite different, which are time-like. This killing vector, the normal one, t goes to t plus a constant, that's time-like over the whole space-time, and that defines the real vacuum, which is the Minkowski space vacuum. And we have, but when we go into the accelerated observer's coordinate system, we also have another time-like killing vector. It's just by looking at this metric, it's obvious that it doesn't depend on t anywhere, and that's basically a sufficient condition. That killing vector, little t goes to little t plus c, which is a different killing vector, and this is going to define what we're going to call the Rindler vacuum. Yeah. If you have the symmetries, right. So what you need for no ambiguity whatsoever is a single global time-like killing vector, right? And that you have in Minkowski space because it's part of the whole 10 parameter symmetries, and you have it in anti-de Sitter space because it's part of the whole 10 parameter symmetries. But it's not in de Sitter space because even though you have 10 killing vectors, none of them are globally time-like. We'll get to that later. So this is, in a sense, a warm-up to that because we're going to a coordinate system where what you see in the accelerated observer's frame of reference is that this, of course, is time-like in this system because it's I put the plus there correctly, it would have been time-like. This is obviously time-like because this is a positive number in this region. But actually, when you analytically continue back out into this region and you say, what is the Killing vector? This number becomes negative in the rest of the space, making this space-like. So this Killing vector is not globally time-like, it's just time-like in the region we're interested in. Okay, so because we're doing a massless scalar in two dimensions, standard fact is that a massless scalar in two dimensions is conformally invariant. That means if I write the metric g mean u as omega squared times another metric g mean u prime, that the factor of omega will just drop out of the equations of motion. And this you can see quite straightforwardly if you just write out the action. Which is something like that. In the two coordinate systems, in the original Cartesian coordinate system, the one that covers the whole space, this is just the normal thing, d phi dt squared minus a half d phi dx squared, capital X squared. Now, this combination is conformally invariant simply because in two dimensions alone, root minus g also scales like omega squared when you do the transformation. And if g mean u is omega squared g mean u prime, then requiring that g mean u inverse times itself is 1 obviously forces this statement. So the inverse of g has to transform like the inverse of the conformal transformation. And so what you have in this combination is the inverse of g, which goes like 1 over omega squared, times root minus g, which goes like omega squared. And so it's clear that root minus g, g mean u, is root minus g prime mean u. So that means the conformal factor will just drop out. But we know that the original Cartesian coordinates, minus dt squared plus dx squared, are conformal, be it to this or be it to that, to the coordinates, the small t, small x coordinates, that cover the Rindler region the Rindler patch that describes the accelerated observer. So without any thought whatsoever, I can immediately write down that the original action in that region alone must be the same as the action written in terms of the small x and small t coordinates integrated over small x and small t. Of course, what this derivative is completely different than what that derivative is, and so on. And so we've done a non-trivial transformation in there, but the whole action is invariant under that transformation. So this fact means we're going to quantize it two ways in this region, because we can do. We're going to quantize the scalar field using the global coordinates and using the Rindler coordinates. And the quantization is thankfully simple, because for a massless scalar field in two dimensions, the solutions are always, so we have, let's suppose we start in the global coordinates. We know in general that the solutions split up into right movers and left movers. So the most general solution of an equation of this form, of course, splits into a right mover, which is something that goes like t minus x plus a left mover that goes like t plus x. This can be made more transparent by noting that this equation is just the same as d2 phi dx plus dx minus, yeah.
So what was the difference between the small t and the big t?
So the capital T, capital X are the coordinates that cover the whole space. So that's capital T is infinity, capital X is infinity. Small t and x are these coordinates that are not Cartesian coordinates because there's this factor in front. They're the coordinates that just cover this region. So these are the lines of constant small x, and the lines of constant small t look like something like this. Okay. So for now, just to make the notation clear, that capital T and X are the Minkowski coordinate, the embedding coordinate, not embedding, but the coordinates that cover everybody, and the small ones are just the coordinates that cover the Rindler patch. So standard trick for two-dimensional mass conformal invariant theories is that we can split the field up into right movers and left movers. This is what you do in string theory all the time. And of course, this is equivalent to just saying x minus x plus. Now, because of this separation, actually, we don't really need to solve the whole field. We can just solve the right movers. We can always get the left movers by direct analogy because they satisfy all the same equations. And the only difference is you have an x minus, x plus dependence here instead of an x minus dependence here. And the operators in the two guys will will commute. So from now on, we can really just focus on one of the two guys, just the right movers, quantize that, and everything we say will go over for the left movers quite analogously. So conformal invariance of the equations of motion means that also it is true that the wave equation could have been written in the form where we had the small t's in the coordinates that cover the Rindler patch. Furthermore, we're also defining small x plus or minus, which are the natural light cone coordinates on the Rindler patch in terms of t plus or minus x. And so this equation is the same as d2 phi dx plus dx minus. So it also follows that in the Rindler patch coordinates, it must be possible to write the most general solution in terms of right movers and left movers. Now, for a second, you might think, well, do I mean the same thing here? Is the right mover here the same as the right mover here? Is the left mover here the same as the left mover here? Well, it is. It must be the same, because if you look at the map between the coordinates, it's true that capital X plus is only a function of little x plus, and capital X minus is only a function of little x minus. And so what is effectively going on in going from here to here is that we're taking this guy by our capital X plus, and then we plug in that capital X plus is 1 over a e to the a little x plus, and then that really defines for us a new function of little x plus. And so if we were being careful, we should put some tilde or something to say that these are actually distinct functions. So that's really good because it means that our notion of right movers and left movers is exactly the same in both coordinate systems. And so when I concentrate just on right movers in the global coordinate system, I'm also concentrating just on right movers here. And so from now on, we can just forget the left movers until the very end and just quantize the right mover system. Okay, so the key point is that in this, we can quantize in two distinct ways in this region. The methods look very similar, but in fact they're very different. So the standard, the Minkowski global coordinate quantization would follow something like this. We would write phi r, which is a function of x minus, the right mover, in terms of an integral over momenta, and then we want to split into positive and negative frequency modes. And because we're on Minkowski space, there isn't any ambiguity in how to do this. There's a natural way to do it, which is, so we write down annihilation operator, and then we want to have a positive frequency mode. Remember that the definition of x minus is such that it's t minus x. So positive frequency means something going to like e to the minus t. So we want something that goes like e to the minus x plus. Because of that fact, instead of integrating over all p, we only want to integrate from 0 to infinity, and that's a reflection of the fact that because we split into left and right movers, we're effectively also splitting the momenta into positive momenta and negative momenta, and if we're only talking about the right movers, I can restrict the momenta integral over to the half the range instead of the normal infinite range. And then with that trick, this is what we mean by the positive energy mode. And then the other guy is just the Mission conjugate as normal. And these guys, of course, you go through the normal canonical quantization conditions. An AP prime has to be 2 pi times a delta function. AP with AP prime is 0, and its emission conjugate is 0. So they satisfy the standard commutation relations. So this is nothing other than just standard quantum field theory, with the only slight distinction is that because we've split into left and right movers, we've cut the range of the integration, and so we don't need to put any moduluses of P. This P here is manifestly positive. But we also have the quantization in the Rindler coordinates. And the thing that the conformal invariance does for us is it guarantees the equations of motion are exactly the same. We can do the same split. Right movers map to right movers. So without any thought whatsoever, we can immediately write down the same formula for the same field. Not the same, an analogous formula, I should say, for the same field. Except we have to be careful. The quantities that are going to be creation annihilation operators will certainly not be the same. So we'll call them B. That's a K there. That's a K dagger. And that's e to the plus ik x minus. And again, the range of integration over this momenta is split between from 0 to plus infinity. These modes, so remember that similarly to x, capital minus is t minus x. X little minus is t minus x. And t is the guy that's a killing vector, is a time-like killing vector in the Rindler patch, and is the quantity, is the time, the it actually is the proper time of an accelerated observer, and therefore is the natural time that the accelerator observer uses to say what he calls, or he or she calls, the positive and negative frequency modes. And so this guy really does go like e to the minus ikt. K is being assumed to be positive. And so this really is the positive energy mode. This guy is the negative energy mode. Now, these fields must satisfy canonical commutation relations just the same way. And if we were quantizing in this form, we would say that the momenta conjugate was d phi to capital T just by differentiating, defining the momenta in the normal way. And so we would demand a relationship that phi at x it equal capital times with pi x prime it equal capital times is equal to I delta x minus x prime. Whereas over here, we would have defined quite a different momenta, P, which is defined a little t, which is certainly not equal to pi. Oop. And we would have demanded an equal time commutation relations on a different time surface. Here we have equal time commutation relations on constant t surface. Here we have it on constant little t. So we'd have demanded some statement like this. And at first sight, these look extremely different because capital X is certainly not the same as little x. In fact, the two are mixed up together, the space and time quantities. And that's because here we're defining the canonical commutation relations on fundamentally different surfaces. These are ones which are constant surfaces in the global coordinate, constant time surfaces in the global coordinate system, and these ones are constant time surfaces in the Rindler coordinate system that look something like that. Nevertheless, it turns out that in fact these are completely equivalent quantizations. It doesn't make any difference to within the Rindler region. These basically are equivalent quantizations, and the requirement of the second condition amounts to saying that the BK with BK dagger must satisfy two pi delta K minus K prime, just the normal formula, but. Secretly, of course, what we're doing is defining the inner product on quite a different surface to get that formula. Now, the fact that this surface only covers inside this region, whereas this surface covers the whole space-time, is going to be the crucial fact. What that translates out as is that if we take a state that's a pure state on the whole space-time, because this coordinate system only covers part of the space-time, the state that you'll perceive, that a pure state on the global space-time, will always look like a mixed state in the Rindler patch. Yeah.
Basically, what is happening, you're tracing out.
Yes. Secretly tracing out.
And that's basically what's giving
that. That's right. You don't see the tracing out, but we are tracing out. When we write that statement, we're defining that by using the inner product, which is defined on these space-like surfaces. And so in this region, I can use both guys. This gives me far more information because this is well-defined over the whole space. This is only well-defined in this region. So there's more information in this than this. Now, clearly, that in the region where they overlap, this guy can be used to describe that. But the fact that there's more information here and here means that when we look at a state that's pure for this guy, and we look at what it looks like to this guy, it'll look like a mixed state because the information that this guy can't describe will have to be traced over effectively, and that in a sense that's why we always get a temperature in these situations where we have horizons, because when we have a horizon we have to trace over the degrees of freedom that lie beyond a horizon because we can't see it by definition. But when we trace in quantum mechanics, we trace a pure state, we always get a mixed state, and the classic example of a mixed state is a thermal state. And then we get a temperature. Yeah. Yes. My small x is a slightly more curly. My capital X is a straight. Yeah. So secretly, although these formulas look, you know, temptingly familiar, of course there's quite a difference going on between them, because we're really defining fields, the definition of the quantum field, over different regions of space. Nevertheless, this guy is supposed to equal this guy in the region of interest, in the Rindler patch. Okay, so these are not different fields, these are the same field being written in two different coordinate systems. That's very important. Okay, so now this situation is not dissimilar to the particle creation situation, where we had two different ways of writing the fields, one in terms of the vacuum defined at minus infinity, where we use the A's, one in terms of the vacuum, the out vacuum defined at plus infinity. So there are clearly, when we have two different definitions of creation annihilation operators, and these certainly are different, it means we have two different vacua. There's the one, the standard Minkowski vacua, which is defined to be annihilated by the A's, APs, for all P. And there is the Rindler vacua, which is defined as annihilated by the B's for all K. And so we see here the And the manifest observer dependence in the definition of a vacuum. A guy who's at rest or in an inertial frame in Minkowski space will always use this as the vacuum. That's the vacuum we use on a daily basis, if you like, when we do particle physics. Whereas an accelerated observer will use this as his natural definition, vacuum. And these two things are not the same. In fact, it's worse than that. They're not even a unitary transformation of each other. Because, precisely because of this tracing thing. We're not actually dealing, to make the map between Minkowski and Rindler, we have to do it not at the level of states, but the level of density matrices. Because what will happen is that basically the density matrix of, if we write the pure state, Minkowski state, as a density matrix, what effectively we're doing, we take that pure state, we need to trace out the degrees of freedom that lie outside the horizon. And in doing that, we get the density matrix in the Rindler region, and that will turn out to be certainly not the Rindler vacuum. In fact, it will turn out basically to be a thermal state where this is the e to the minus beta h, where that's the Hamiltonian in the Rindler patch. So the key point is these vacua are very different. Nevertheless, this field must equal that field. Okay? That means that individually, this mode must be expressible as a superposition of these modes. Because they're both solutions of the equation of motion. They're both the most general solutions we can have of the equations of motion, at least in the Rindler region. So it has to be the case that we can re-express the positive frequency mode in the global system and let me write out, I guess I forgot the normalizations, but standard normalizations. Should have put that in. It has to be that we can write out the mode that we call positive frequency in the global coordinate system as a superposition of the modes we call positive and negative frequency, or negative energy, in the Rindler coordinate system, because this thing is equal to that thing. The whole integral is equal. Term by term, it's not the same, but the whole integral is certainly equal to each other. So that means there must exist a relationship of the form where this guy could be written as a superposition where the coefficients in general depend on k and p of e to the minus I k x minus over root 2k plus beta kp e to the plus I k x minus over root 2k. And then everything is integrated there. Now, this decomposition looks extremely familiar. It's exactly the kind of thing we did when we wrote the in vacuum, when we were looking at the scattering type process, where we look at particle creation in the co-space time. And we wrote the in vacuum, what the in vacuum looks like at late times, as a superposition of the out vacuum positive energy modes and the complex conjugate of the out vacuum negative energy modes, where these guys, in that case, were called the Bogoliubov coefficients, or Bogoliubov. Everyone says it different ways. Never know which is the right way to say it. So this statement is very analogous. It basically looks like what we're doing is taking the original modes, doing some Bogoliubov transformation, and then integrating over all the different memento. Now you might guess, well, is there an analogous thing where, of course, I could take this guy and rewrite it as a superposition over these guys? And the answer is no, in general, because these functions are defined over the whole space, but these ones are only defined in the Rindler patch. And so if we could go this way from here to here, then we would be rewriting a set of functions that's only valid in a restricted region, the Rindler patch, but we would be somehow taking them to be defined in a region where they're not supposed to be defined. So we can certainly go this way, because these functions are defined everywhere on the space. These are the mode functions on the global system, and these are the mode functions just in the Rindler patch. Now, if we take that relationship, plug it in here, just as before, we can basically infer... Yep. Yeah. Sorry, it does look terrible, doesn't it? So what I meant was the degrees of freedom outside the horizon. So what I'm saying is that's the Rindler patch, and then we're integrating over all the degrees of freedom that lie, whose support lies outside the Rindler patch. Does that make sense? Yeah, so this is the horizon. That's the bit we're covering with our coordinate system in the Rindler patch. That's the bit we're throwing away. So you integrate out everything, trace out everything that lies outside of that. So just as before, if we take these mode functions, if we take that expression for the mode functions and plug it into this formula, then basically what we're doing is effectively inferring a formula for the BKs, where BK, in terms of the A's, BK ends up being... So when we write this guy, we'll have a positive frequency part here, and so there'll be a part where BK goes like an integral over P times AP times that coefficient... And there's a 2 pi there. And then in here, this guy is the complex conjugate of that mode function. So when we take the complex conjugate, we'll get beta complex conjugated. This will then become a positive frequency mode. And so we'll get a contribution that looks like beta kp star times ap dagger. So this is very analogous to a relationship we derived earlier in the case of scattering between in and out. There it was a much simpler relationship. It was just a statement that BK was alpha K AK plus beta K star AK dagger, some relationship like that. Yeah. That's an alpha, yeah. Big button. Alpha KP. And so this, what that formula did... as before, so we can either do the Bogoliubov transformation at the level of the modes, or we can do it at the level of the creation annihilation operators. And here what we're doing is saying, effectively, how do I construct the annihilation operator that defines the Rindler vacuum in terms of the annihilation and creation operators that define the Minkowski vacuum? And this is the explicit formula for that. Now, one direct consequence of this thing is, of course, we still demand a relationship like BK, BK dagger is 2 pi delta K minus K prime. We still demand that these satisfy the canonical commutation relations, but we know that these satisfy the commutation relations and for the P's, and so if you plug through what that implies, this essentially says that there's a normalization condition that looks like alpha k p alpha k prime p star minus beta k prime p beta star k p prime is equal to 2 pi times a delta function in K and K prime. Where you get that from is just taking this expression, you plug it into this formula, B and B dagger, you'll get, for example, an alpha A commuting with an alpha star A dagger, and then you know what the AA dagger is, it gives you a delta function, gets rid of one of the momentum integrals, and will give you an expression like this. And this is actually just the sort of general formula for general condition that the Galyubov coefficients have to satisfy when they actually depend on two, when the momentum changes between the two representations. And this is analogous to the condition we had to satisfy before, that mod alpha squared minus mod beta squared was equal to 1. Okay, that's the analog condition. Yeah? Sorry, that, yeah, you're right. The P's are not primed, because that's what you're integrating over, but the K and K prime. Right. Okay. So that's those are the formulae you have to satisfy. They're just forced on you by requiring that the fields satisfy the commutation relations. This thing is forced on you just by saying that the modes on the global coordinates must be re-expressible as a superposition of modes in the Rindler coordinates. And the point is that in some sense, like as before when we did the particle creation problems, mod beta squared was telling us about the number density of particles we produce. And that's still more or less true here, that this quantity here is basically determining the number of particles we have, except we're not producing them now, because we haven't got some time-dependent system. We're simply changing our frame of reference. We're going from the frame of reference of an inertial observer in Minkowski space to an accelerated frame of reference. Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how you got that expression for BK.
Which one? This one.
Yep.
So what I'm doing is I'm taking that formula and I'm plugging it in here, and I'm plugging the complex conjugate of it in here, and then I compare this formula and this formula. I just compare the coefficients of e to the minus I k x minus, and then I read off that when I compare the two, that bk must have, that e to the ip x minus, yeah, that bk has to have a part that goes like a and a part that goes like a dagger. So effectively what we're saying is that this positive energy mode in the global system has an alpha bit that's positive energy here plus a beta bit that's negative energy. But when you complex conjugate that part, the beta bit becomes beta star times a positive energy mode. So then when you plug that in, B will get a contribution. B is the coefficient of the positive energy modes in the Rindler coordinates. It'll get a contribution from here that's proportional to alpha, and I get a contribution from here that's proportional to beta star. So I don't want to go through all the details because it'll take a little bit of time, but that's how it plays out. So this thing, this quantity is going to represent in some sense the number density of particles that we have in the Rindler coordinate system, very analogous to what we had in the particle creation process. They are, that's a good question. There probably are, yes. However, they won't be important in what I'm going to do. Let me not write them down. Yeah, because I'm getting this one from this guy. I think there are probably, yes, some conditions, maybe. But they won't be important in where we're going. So basically what we want to do is calculate these quantities because of their interpretation. They're effectively going to represent the number of particles that we effectively see in the Rindler vacuum, and we need to calculate them. How do we calculate them? Well, it's pretty easy, actually. We just do a Fourier transform in the x minus direction. This is a function of e to the minus I kx minus. So if we take the mode, this guy, if we multiply by e to the plus ik x minus, remember that this is a capital X minus, this is the little x minus, and then we integrate over x minus, little x minus, from minus infinity to plus infinity. Well, what happens is that the e to the plus ikx minus will simply project out this part. Okay, it'll only project out this part. It won't project out this part because the integral here is such that we integrate from k is 0 to infinity, so that this is always an e to the plus ikx minus. Similarly, if this k is positive, that's a sum of e to the plus ik, sum of two positive things. And so those things, when you integrate, are always oscillating, and there's no way for the phases to cancel out. Whereas this guy has a minus, so when multiplied by a plus, there will be a case where it can cancel out, and you get a non-zero delta function contribution. And the delta function will just pick out, get rid of that delta function here, and will allow us to infer this relationship. So let me write out what I mean by that. What I'm saying is the following statement. Okay, this quantity is, of course, 2 pi times delta k1 minus k2. But if k1 and k2 are both positive, then we can have a non-zero delta function. But if k2 is negative and k1 is positive, then we've got a delta function of a sum of something that's positive, which can never be zero, and so that just gives zero. So that's why, if as long as k is positive here, we're guaranteed when we multiply and we integrate to only pick out the part that's negative here. That's the only one that's going to give a delta function. We won't pick out this term. So we do the analogous relationship for the betas. For the betas, we just need to pick out the opposite guy. So we have beta kp over root 2k is the integral dx minus infinity to plus infinity e to the minus ikx minus e to the minus ipx minus over root 2p. Okay, so that's how we infer alpha and beta. And all we've got to do is do those integrals. That sounds easy in principle. Well, they're pretty horrendous integrals if you think about it, because remember that this x minus is actually minus 1 over a e to the minus ax minus. So what we have here is a Fourier transform, but also with something with an exponential of an exponential, which is quite hard to deal with. So we're not going to do those integrals at all. We're going to use a trick, a little mathematical trick, to evaluate them. And this same trick is the same trick that can be used in the de Sitter case, and indeed in the black hole case. And the trick is as follows. So let's think about the integral. So we're integrating over little x minus. Now, when little x minus goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, that's what covers the Rindler coordinate system. But that certainly does not correspond to x, capital X minus, going from minus infinity to plus infinity. This guy is always negative. So capital X minus goes from 0 to minus infinity, or minus, I guess, minus infinity to 0. So this integral is extremely rapidly oscillating guy, and it's not apparent how it's convergent at all. So what we're going to do is the sort of standard trick when we have very oscillatory integrals is effectively deform them into the complex plane and make them convergent, make them into convergent integrals. So we need to think about which is the right way to deform them. I'm going to do this over here. So I don't want to rub that off. So the standard trick is so if x minus is going to minus infinity, then what we'd really like to do is replace e to the minus I p x minus. Remember that p is positive. So we want to replace that by something that goes like e to the plus p x minus. If we can do that replacement, then as x, we're now guaranteed that this will converge, at least as x minus goes to minus infinity, because this becomes minus infinity, so this goes to zero. Of course, if we did it the other way, then it would go to infinity, and so that wouldn't be good. So what we're going to do is effectively find some way of going into the complex plane in the little x minus coordinates such that this oscillatory quantity, which doesn't look apparently convergent, will become a convergent quantity, so the integral becomes well-defined. And the trick is quite simple. We just have to look at what x minus is. So x minus, capital X minus, in terms of the original coordinates, sorry, in terms of the Rindler coordinates, is this combination here. So to get from here to here, what we need to do is basically have x minus goes to I x minus. That's our complexification that will take this thing to this thing. How do we achieve that in terms of the little x coordinates? Well, it's actually quite simple. We just do little x minus goes to x minus minus 1 over a I pi over 2. The reason being is that then e to the minus ax minus goes to e to the plus I pi over 2 e to the minus ax minus. And e to the plus I pi over 2, of course, is just I. So then it follows that, indeed, with this shift in the Rindler in the Rindler light cone coordinate, then the space-time light cone coordinate actually becomes imaginary. That makes this quantity become this, which is now convergent as capital X minus goes to minus infinity. So, of course, secretly we're just deforming the contour in the complex plane and so on, and we could do this in a more rigorous way. So what we're actually doing then is, if we're thinking in the complex sense, this is x minus. We're taking the original integral, which goes from minus infinity out to plus infinity, and then we're essentially shifting the integration by an imaginary quantity. So we're shifting it off into the imaginary plane by an amount I pi over 2a. And then we're going to assume that the contributions at infinity drop to zero, which is guaranteed if the integral becomes convergent. And that's how we're doing the integral. Now, under that trick, e to the I k x minus, little x minus, will map, because of the shift in the imaginary piece, well, you'll pick up an extra contribution that will go like e to the k pi over 2a e to the I kx minus. And that's coming from the ik here multiplied by this thing, the minus I times minus I gives you 1, and then you get the pi over 2a multiplied by k. So with this mathematical shenanigans, we deform the integration such that this thing, because of the shift by an imaginary piece, will pick up this factor, e to the k pi over 2a times the original thing. And this quantity, instead of being oscillatory, becomes e to the p capital Xi, which is now actually convergent because Xi is going to minus infinity, as well as the overall root 2p. And that's it. Similarly, this expression here, basically the same trick. In fact, this thing is the same as before. The only difference is there's a minus sign here. The only effect of that is when we do the shift of xi by an imaginary piece, we pick up now that contribution going the other way around. So this integral is the same as dx minus minus infinity to plus infinity e to the minus k pi over 2a. Oh, so there's a minus here. So this is the only difference, this extra contribution that we pick up by the shift in little x minus, such that this quantity now becomes convergent. You pick up a different real part here and here. Now, the consequence of that is that if you just look at these formula for a second, now in this new form, it is apparent that alpha kp is basically the same as e to the k pi over a beta kp star. Because the only difference between these formulas is this real part in the exponential and the I here being a minus I there and minus I. So this formula is just the complex conjugate of that with an additional different factor. And so we infer this statement. So although we haven't calculated the alphas and betas themselves directly, we have at least seen how the two are related to each other. But then we can remember that also they're normalized in this sense. In particular, if I take this formula, the normalization formula, and I take k equal k prime, well, on the right-hand side, I get 2 pi times a delta function of 0. But this is the normal story. Of course, when you have a delta function of 0 in momentum space, you should really go back to position space and then note that the take the original integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, v to the I0 that defined it, and then cut it off and make it finite length. And this is just the same trick we did for the particle creation. The actual total number of particles you produce is always infinite. What's finite is the number per unit volume. Here we're in two dimensions, so what will be finite is the number per unit length. So the fact that we have to put in this cutoff here, the length, is just a reflection of that fact. When we do that, this formula says that integral dp over 2 pi, 0 to infinity, of mod alpha kp squared minus mod beta kp squared is equal to L. So again, this is the analog of our previous formula, mod alpha squared minus mod beta squared was 1, that the Bogoliubov coefficients had to satisfy. And now we can take this information from here. If we know alpha in terms of beta, we can rewrite this and say the integral from 0 to infinity is e to the 2k pi over a minus 1 multiplied by mod beta kp squared is equal to L. Now this integral is over p, but this factor that comes out is not dependent upon p. And so we can rewrite that as the statement that the integral dp over 2 pi 0 to infinity of mod beta pk squared is equal to L over e to the 2 pi, and I'll write it as mod k even though k is positive, over a minus 1. But what you see here is basically the Bose-Einstein distribution. So it's the thermal distribution for bosons. This is, in standard language, this is L over E to the E over K Boltzmann T minus 1, where we identify K as E, which it is because we're massless in two dimensions, so everything's traveling at the speed of light, so the energy is just the momenta. And with that identification, we find that KB is A over 2 pi, which is the previously stated result for the Henry temperature. So to complete the connection, I only need to convince you that this is the quantity that we thought it was, counting the number of particles. And indeed it is, and basically it's the same, more or less the same reasoning as before. If you remember that how you write BK in terms of the alpha, the A's, that was the transformation. So the question to ask in the present case is, if we are in the Minkowski vacuum, how many particles does an accelerated observer see? An accelerated observer defines his number of particles using the B creation annihilation operators. So the number of particles that the accelerated observer sees, this is actually the number of right-moving particles because we're just looking at the right-moving modes, but we get an analogous contribution for the left movers. The accelerated observer would define their number of particles using the B creation and annihilation operators, because that is the definition, because we define the Rindler vacuum, which is the vacuum of the accelerated observer. So that's the definition for which the number of Rindler particles in the vacuum would give zero. But we're not in the Rindler vacuum. We're in the Minkowski vacuum. So the correct question to ask is, what is the expectation value of this? Let me write it over here so as not to get too low. What is the expectation value of the number of B particles in the Minkowski vacuum? This is the precise analog of what we did before, where we said we're in the instate. We're always in the instate in the Heisenberg representation, because that's the state at minus infinity. By definition, that's the state we remain in. And then we calculate the number of out particles using the out vacuum. So that was what we did in the time-dependent particle creation context. Here it's really an observer-dependent, but it's basically the same trick. But the calculation goes much like before. We have, this is integral dk 0 to pi mink expectation value of bk dagger bk Minkowski. And then we plug in this expression. And of course, this guy just annihilates the Minkowski vacuum. So the only part that gives a non-zero contribution when you apply b on the Minkowski vacuum to the right is this quantity. So that will give us, we'll get an integral dk dp dp prime. So this piece will give us an AP dagger acting on the Minkowski vacuum times beta pk star . This is from this part acting to the right. And then we have the emission conjugate acting to the left. And just as before, this guy, emission conjugate acting to the left, also gives zero. So it's this guy, again, that is the only guy that does anything, acting to the left. That'll give a beta star p prime k, and then an AP prime with a Minkowski vacuum to the left. So in other words, these pieces always drop out when we ask this question. Yeah?
Okay. To change this normalization so we get a thermodynamic distribution.
Say that again?
Are we able to change this normalization?
This is the normalization for bosons. Right. So if for fermions, we'd have to do a separate calculation, and basically the sign would come out the other way. But yeah, sorry, this one is not going to star, right? Because I'm taking B dagger will be A dagger alpha star plus beta A. Same calculation as before. And then what you see is that the AP with, so as normal, if we calculate the expectation value of AP prime AP dagger in the Minkowski vacuum, well, you just commute these guys, and that gives you 2 pi times the delta function, which sets p prime equal to p. That gets rid of me the p prime integral, and I'm left with integral dk, and I'll put the 2 pi's in for good measure, integral dp over 2 pi, and then multiplied by mod beta pk squared. And then now we know this formula, the integral over p of mod b2k squared is a thermal distribution in k. So this answer is just the integral dk from 0 to infinity L, because it's infinite, number of particles is infinite, number of unit length is finite, divided by e to the 2 pi k over a minus 1. And that is what we mean when we say the Rindler vacuum, when we say that an accelerated observer perceives a thermal distribution of particles at temperature A over 2 pi when the actual state of the universe is the Minkowski vacuum. And that is the Unruh effect. Any questions on that? Right. So you mean just the Euclideanization thing?
Yes.
So in fact, we also Euclideanized here, right? Because what we did is this trick of shifting x minus by a little imaginary piece is exactly the same trick. So when we take, so the reason Euclideanization works is because to define what we mean by positive frequency modes, a field theory in Minkowski space is always ill-defined at some level, because what we have is these very oscillatory functions that if you write down the naive formula for propagators, they're never convergent. So we always have to make some way of dealing with the convergence. We have to do something to make them convergent, like we put in the I epsilon prescription or something like that. Of course, that's just the I epsilon is just a dodgy thing, but you can justify it in a slightly more rigorous way, in that what you're effectively doing is taking this real function and then deforming it into the complex, one half of the complex plane, and making the propagator or whatever you're calculating convergent by going into the complex plane. And so, for example, so a positive frequency mode, if you make T imaginary, we have an imaginary piece now. So this would be e to the minus I omega t real, e to the plus omega t imaginary. So as long as you deform this into the lower half of the complex plane, so t imaginary is negative, then you'll get an exponential that as energy goes to infinity, this thing will drop to zero and make things convergent. So in other words, positive frequency modes are somehow naturally defined on the lower half complex plane, negative frequency modes on the upper half complex plane. Now what the Euclideanization trick does is simply to say, instead of calculating things along here, I'm going to calculate things along here. But you could have done even better. You could have just said, I'm going to define my propagators and everything on the whole lower half complex plane. And the Euclidean answer gets one part of that, and the real answer gets just the limit of that coming in. And so it's the same here. When to make sense of this integral, which was very ill-defined at some level, because of this fact, we had to deform it into the complex plane. We deformed it into the lower half complex plane. But because everything is analytic in this half, then that's equivalent, at some level that's equivalent to basically what we get when we do the Euclidean trick. Does that make sense? It still seems like there's something, you know, of a sleight of hand about it, and there always is. You know, but if you look in, of course, there is a feeling you shouldn't do this because on a curved space-time, you know, there isn't a unique way to go into the complex plane if things are complicated function of time. But what it can be said is that, you know, at least in the cases where we know there is a well-defined Euclideanization, we can actually, there's a bigger justification that we can make sense of field theory really in the whole lower half and upper half complex plane. Of course, now you're doing the same trick when you do twisters and stuff, right, that you some, as you know. So, yeah. The last line of the center?
Yeah.
2 pi k of A, yes. It's the same, yeah. So the temperature, K Boltzmann temperature is A over 2 pi. The energy is K. And so this is just E to the E over KT. Okay. All right. So, yeah. So tomorrow we'll continue more with De Sitter. Yeah.